Welcome to the For Money Audio Commentary. This is David Fuller on Friday, the 8th of February, recording at 8:50 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. Now, this being Friday, this is the big picture long-term outlook for the various asset classes, but first a quick review of the week. For stock markets, where they've been opened, remember many of those Asian markets, the Chinese markets, are closed for the Year of the Rat celebrations. Happy New Year to you all. But elsewhere, I say it has been a bit of a nervous week of retracements following the pretty good rallies that we saw during the previous more than 2 weeks. Now, slightly steadier action here in Asia today, and Wall Street's been pegging back losses, but is currently down about 50 in the Dow as I speak. I'll give a wrap on that if I can remember towards the close. But more importantly, what else is going on in here? In terms of government bonds, we had some weakness, particularly in the U.S. Treasuries following the auction yesterday. They have pegged that back by regaining almost a point in here today. But mostly those are range trading. The U.S. dollar has rebounded here today. Moving close, I beg your pardon, rebounded over the last week, moving back above the middle of its trading range, which is really sort of centered on that 76.20 level. It's down today at currently 76.66. That's down 277 ticks, following, as I say, some fairly sharp gains, but only to the upper side of a trading range. And commodities, these have been the really interesting stories in here today. Recently, the grain and bean complex has picked up once again, and led very much by wheat, which has been very strong, and followed by soybeans. Wheat closed limit up in here again today. As a matter of fact, I think it's been limit up just about every day this week. And according to evidence from that Minneapolis wheat market, there could be further to go in the short term. More on that in a moment. Now, the other agricultural commodities have all been quite firm in here. And this week, and every single one of them is up today, all the ones that I've been able to spot at any rate. And it's been a generally good week for metals. Platinum has just been soaring in here, and it's been up every single day. And look at this price, $18,090 for the April platinum. It wasn't all that long ago that was trading at around $15.50, less than a month. And gold, again, this has had a good 3 days in here. It had come down earlier in the week and last week, but gold bullion currently trading at 920, and silver up 40 cents in here today. March silver is currently at 1717. And palladium has just been blasting, having completed its base formation earlier in the week. It's at 439, up another 10 in here today. The industrial metals have also been stronger, but those gains pale compared to the precious metals, although copper has staged a brisk rally in here today. You remember a lot of people had written copper's obituary a bit prematurely. Currently trading at 352. That's the spot U.S. price for copper. And natural gas has been steady. Currently 8.277 on the first month contract. And crude up $3.67, back above 90, so currently trading at 91.80. Okay, commodities to the fore. That's very much the story. So what's going on here overall? Well, I use the word nervous conditions for stock markets. That's an understatement. And the general tone of sentiment is very nervous to very, very bearish. And it's hardly surprising as to why that's the case, because stock markets had been ranging defensively, and it actually not doing all that well since last July, and certainly October. And then all the subprime stuff, I won't go and review all that, you know all that, had been alarming investors. And there were plenty of alarmist stories making the rounds. And then we had that disastrous start to the year in January. Big falls all around. So that's terrified people. So you get a very, very bearish a general view overall. Now, the Fuller Money template here, first, we maintain that. Well, this is not a theory. There was clearly a selling climax on the 22nd of January. Panicky action the first 2 days of the week, the Monday during which the U.S. markets had been closed. And then we got the dramatic interest rate cuts from Bernanke and Co. And then we had the big short covering rally, and a lot of those stock markets, well, they retraced everything from. Well, the weaker ones didn't do all that much, but the not quite that weak ones regained about a third of their overall declines. A lot of markets regained about half of their overall declines, and the stronger ones regained at least two-thirds of their overall declines. And the ones that did best were miners. And also the food producers, particularly the inform food producers, Indonesia, for instance, classic example of all that palm oil. Okay, so what do we make of this very bearish sentiment and the technical action? Well, staying with the technical action here first, you may recall the Fuller Money template. On this, is that following the selling climax, it was inevitable that, well, I described the rally, and Owen and I described the rally as mainly short covering, a little bit of bargain hunting, but mostly bear covering. And once that ran out, inevitably we would get a reaction. And the template is that if the selling climax marked the low, capital THE rather than a low. If it was the low, then we would find most stock market indices encountering support above, near or above their low on the 22nd of January, and then moving back up above whatever rally high we have seen recently. And that would suggest that new demand, long demand, was overpowering the selling pressure from stale bulls and bear traders, and that would create at least a short, or that would create a short-term uptrend, improving sentiment further. Now that's a big ask for that to occur quickly, because of the general fears that are circulating in the markets. And also, anybody who looks at those charts can see plenty of overhead resistance, particularly on the Western markets. So that's the overall background. We've seen a partial retracement of those short covering gains that I described, and it's kind of moment of truth territory here over the next few weeks. Some volatility is just about inevitable. And markets usually thrash around at important lows and important tops. And the selling climax was an important event. Now, are those lows going to hold or not? Well, nobody knows for sure. I don't think an important market has broken those lows yet, although I noticed the Russian indexes slipped below them, but I think the ones that count, and the one that counts the most psychologically, is Wall Street because of the leash effect. That would certainly be noticed around the world if Wall Street were to take out its lows of the 22nd for more than a day or two. Now, in addition to expecting some volatility in here, I would just comment on that bearish sentiment, and a lot of people are inclined to say, well, gosh, look at all that terrible news that's coming out from the banks, and they're going to say, how could markets possibly go up against that background? And of course, everybody's screaming, bear market, bear market, bear market. Well, first, extremes of sentiment are a contrary indicator. And we have had some very interesting technical signals saying that the decline is overextended. I mentioned the VIX index that had run up to 37, same level we saw back in August on the 16th or 17th of August. And but again, people will say, yes, but it didn't go high enough. It wasn't sufficiently climactic. That's sort of a consensus view that we're getting in the markets. My feeling is that it would have been higher had Wall Street not been closed on January 21st, but 37 is a big high number on that VIX index. Other statistics were more impressive. For instance, the AAII study, that's the American Association of Individual Investors. I was told today that bullish sentiment had dropped down to only 20%. Now that's just screaming that markets are near an important low. Then, one that absolutely flabbergasted me that I posted earlier in the week from Bloomberg, they cited I think this was the short interest average figure for January of on the New York Stock Exchange of 3.7%. Now that doesn't sound like a whole lot, does it? Well, that was the highest. That's the number of net short. It's a percentage of net short people, and that is a staggeringly high figure. According to Bloomberg, that's the highest number of shorts in the market since 1931. And of course, shorts in the market have been part of the problem in terms of pushing indices down. I mean, everybody's free to go long or to go short. So I'm certainly not demonizing shorts, but the people who have been running the big short positions, and those are and the banks are certainly among them, having had the early knowledge of their own rather dire problems, started putting out sell recommendations on their competitors on their sector, and generally whooping up the bearish commentary. Well, that's all good fun and games in the markets, but those might not be the most subjective of views, although no one can claim that their view is, I beg your pardon, that might not be the most objective of views, although no one can claim to have an entirely objective view, and it is certainly normal for people to actually talk their book. Other indicators, again, I picked this one up on Bloomberg and posted it, that insider buying on Wall Street reached, well, with insiders became net buyers on Wall Street for the first time since 1995. So that's really, really quite interesting. So that type of evidence suggests to me that if we didn't see the actual lows for most stock markets on the 22nd of January, that we're not far off those levels. Therefore, I am not in this long grinding bear market group, and that's a crowded group. Incidentally, you can decide whether you want to treat that as a contrary indicator or not. Again, I see plenty of value in the markets. Look at the valuation tables that Owen posted, I think it was yesterday. So there's a lot of value out there. Now, okay, the PE ratios, you say that corporate profit estimates are wildly over-optimistic. Even chop those back, and the markets are certainly not that expensive following the shakeout that we've actually seen. So this is all very interesting, and what had been my biggest concern overall was the extent to which the central banks were behind the curve of events, and the Fed attempted to catch up with that 125 basis points of cuts that we saw within 8 days. My own view is that the Fed has not caught up entirely. Had I been running the Fed and been able to call the shots on that, because there are a number of people on the Fed, as you know, it's part of the problem here, working like committee. But frankly, going back right back to October when Bernanke said the risks were balanced. Remember, stock markets had rallied up from those August lows, a number of them, including Wall Street's main indices, hitting new highs. That caused Bernanke to say, amazingly, that the risks were balanced. So it was a pretty naive comment. And markets tanked, and then they were very slow in cutting again, and you know the rest. So back then, I said that was a big mistake. And frankly, go back to the whole point about that I mentioned, you've heard me mention before, that interest rates should be raised like an escalator gradually and lowered like a lift or an elevator. In other words, very, very rapidly. I would have slashed interest rates right back down to 2% before the end of the year, in big chunky moves. But that's neither here nor there. We have to deal with what's actually happened. So I think they're still behind the curve, and not least in the UK. This is going to cause considerable problems for the UK market, and I think the ECB really needs to soften up its stance on rates. Why are they hanging tough in here? Well, because they know they've printed a whole lot of money, and all of these central bankers, and also they see plenty of inflation. But where's the inflation coming from? It's all coming from, it's mostly coming from food prices and also energy prices. Now, that's not something that should be treated with monetary policy, because it just won't work. It's a global problem overall, but that food price inflation, incidentally, is a headwind for stock markets, and not least because it's if food costs more, that's pulling money away from other expenditures within the economy. And of course, it's freaked out the central banks to a certain extent, as I've already mentioned. Now, overall, we're in a new type of environment here, which is characterized by some stagflation and by these very, very strong food prices. And this is going to be choppy. This is going to be hard on people's nerves. And I can feel it in terms of my own nerves. And I certainly know that subscribers feel it. You'd have to be you'd have to be dead not to be sensitive to this. And I think as investors and traders, we have to have a fairly robust attitude about all this. If someone's going to find their health jeopardized when markets churn very violently and get some of these swoons on the downside, then maybe it's not worth actually being in the markets. Now, I think the markets are fantastic. I owe any of the material success that I've had in my life to the markets. I've often described these at seminars as man-made resources for us to harvest when the timing is right. So I'm a big fan of the markets here, but the markets are, of course, or the actions of the markets are dictated by mostly by people, human events. So they are like people, highly volatile, highly emotional. That's life. That's the way life is. And occasionally we get these periods where we have nice, orderly, calm upward trends, but that's the exception to the rule. You know that use that I the term is annoying and overused, but when they talk about a Goldilocks environment where growth isn't too strong to be overheating and it's not too slow to be causing recession worries, and we get nice orderly uptrends. It's nice when it happens, but that's not a permanent state. And it usually is followed by some fairly tumultuous activity. So I think we have to have a fairly robust attitude and approach about all this. That's always easier if one's a bit diversified. And those of you who have been subscribers for long enough to know me, you know that I hold a lot of cash. I always hold a lot of cash. That's just me. And you know that I have a long-term equity investment portfolio, and that's of considerable interest to me, needless to say. And you also know that I have a reasonably active trading account, and over the course of my adult lifetime, that's been the trading account that created the monies that are in the investment account and in the cash account. So I rely for a lot on the overall trading account. Now, everybody's different. And as I've said on so many other occasions, if you are not already a trader, don't think of taking it up. Traders usually start at a very young age, go through a lot of pain, have a steep learning curve. Even if they do well initially, then they give up a lot of money and might do that several times. Most of them, 90% of them, drop by the wayside, and those who survive get well. They get better at it for the most part, but not that they don't get some significant drawdowns from time to time. That's life. We all do. But my point, going back to investors, is that if you have all your eggs in the stock market, then you're going to be stressed out a whole lot more by all this talk of bear trends. And I hope that none of you do have all of your eggs in one basket. And it's the same thing with property and collectibles and other things. And collectibles are a big part of my overall well-being. Well, enough of enough of that discussion. Let's move on here in terms of the markets. Bottom line, I think there's a lot of value around here. If we didn't see the low, I think we certainly saw the penultimate low, and I wouldn't be that surprised if we did see the low. And if you've got something that you regard as good value and with long-term potential, if it's not doing all that well at the moment, I wouldn't be losing that much sleep over it. If it hasn't been doing all that well at the moment, it's probably too late to sell. And if you can be objective and reasonably accurate in terms of that long-term potential, then it's probably a better time to be buying that. It's certainly not a good time, I would suggest, to be actually selling it. So, yes, my China fund position has come down, and that's the one. If I were adding new money to my largely pension funds and ISA accounts, I would probably go for that, as I mentioned, I think earlier in the week or last week. And you know, I bought back on the 22nd, I think it was. I bought some of the Rio Tinto, because that was down so much. and then traded that out following the rally. So these big sell-offs create buying opportunities, is the point I'm trying to make. And all this focus on these US problems, and I get so many emails about the US economic problems. Well, they're considerable here. I certainly don't think it's the end of the world. These banks go bust about once a generation, but of course governments don't let them stay bust. They bail them out, and that's happening this time around. And every time it happens, there is a large group that says it's the end of the world as we know it. And I've seen the end of the world unsuccessfully forecast too many times to try to improve on that record. But I also want to emphasize that, the US is not the world economy. And these fuller money themes, I think, are fantastic. And look at the way some of those Asian markets rebounded very, very strongly following that mid-November sell-off. Of course, they're vulnerable to the Wall Street leash effect. Again, it's because people invest in these things. And if they see Wall Street herring down, then they say, well, maybe my market will fall as well. And even if it's not has nothing to do with the problems that are driving down Wall Street, people will say, well, I think I'll sell it just in case anyway. And this is the type of thing that happens. You know all this, of course. But the fuller money themes, emerging Asia, and the whole global infrastructure story, I mean, these are incredibly attractive themes that are going to run for a long, long time. And of course, the global infrastructure story is also tied in with the resources story. And these have rewarded us handsomely over the last 5, 6 years. And I have little doubt that they will reward us again in future. But we shouldn't expect it to be a smooth ride all the time, and want to bear in mind a little bit of buy low, sell high, or you can buy and hold on that. But if you buy and hold, try to buy low and not get panicked out. The worst thing that can happen is to get panicked out when everybody else is panicking. And watch out when everybody's saying the same thing. When they're all saying the same thing, they're not thinking. And there are an awful lot of people now who are exceptionally bearish right now. And well, that would have been a great idea back in October, just as Bernanke was making his ludicrous equal weighting of risks statement. With hindsight, that would have been an absolutely brilliant time to sell, although some of the fuller money themes subsequently went on to higher levels. But there we are. What about these long-dated government bonds? If we get a global recession, then those yields are going to come me down even lower. I don't think there's any chance whatsoever of getting a global recession. Do we get a global slowdown? Absolutely. That's no bad thing. That will reduce inflationary pressures somewhat, not necessarily the food price and pressures, but don't forget there are a lot of deflationary pressures out there as well. The weak housing market in the US and the UK is a classic example, and in a few other countries. The loan problems that we see, those are deflationary. So overall, I think that the type of inflation that central banks should be concerned about, in other words, not the energy prices and the food prices, because they can't do anything about those, it's wage inflation that they should be most concerned about, and that's not really a problem in this environment. So I don't see this global recession, although you get a sell-off, as we saw in January, and then everybody starts saying, well, that must mean that the fundamentals are vastly worse than we thought previously. Well, what it really means is that a lot of people became quite panicky back in January, and then they start attaching labels to justify that kind of action. And then, of course, there is the exceptionally bearish Armageddon type view promoted by the people who've had the big short positions out there. Again, people talk their book. My feeling is that we saw in US Treasuries, for instance, a buying climax occurring simultaneously with the selling climax on the 22nd of January in the stock market. And I think a topping process is developing here. It may take a fairly long time overall, but I think it's a fairly safe bet that as confidence returns to stock markets, and none of us, I think, would argue against confidence returning, although every single one of you probably has a different view on exactly when the confidence will return to stock markets, and that would be normal and understandable enough. But when it does return, and the evidence of that will be the establishment of short to medium term uptrends for most of the world's stock markets, then I would expect bond prices, long-dated government bond prices, to be in downward trends, short to medium term downward trends. And therefore, that's why I've edged in with some small short positions just to keep my mind focused on those markets. In terms of currencies, the big long-term themes, the bullish currencies are going to be the ones with the best growth rates in countries with the best growth rates. And a lot of those are going to be in Asia. The Asian currencies are generally a bit cheap anyway. And those are going to be hard currencies. Then the developed country resources producers will have generally firm currency. But we also have to remember that in this environment of intense competitive pressures due to globalization, that no country wants a strong currency. And if you want a strong currency, although it's not one that we barter with, in other words, use at the coffee shop or the supermarket or corner deli, it's gold. And gold is continuing to appreciate against all currencies. Now, I have said that the gold uptrend is maturing in terms of its medium-term cycle. And if you look at a long-term chart of gold, you'll see that it gets these long, boring, ranging consolidation phases, followed by a fairly persistent upward trend that then goes into an accelerating overdrive. And those moves are usually led by platinum. And that cycle is repeating itself all over again. I don't think it's over. Certainly, platinum hasn't peaked yet, but acceleration we know is an ending signal. And I would think that probably this medium-term run in gold will be wrapped up in the, where are we now? We're in early February. Probably wrapped up within 2 or 3 months. I will see. The charts will show us. But I think it's one that, from a trading perspective, I want to play, but I'm playing it more cautiously now. In other words, less exposure. I think people who have taken gold bullion on a long-term view is a good alternative investment and currency hedge, on unleveraged positions, in other words, they may not have any qualms about riding out another lengthy medium-term correction of a year or so. Of course, it could be shorter. Next time, bull markets tend to speed up towards their latter overall stages, but I wouldn't be surprised if gold moves a whole lot higher over the next decade or so. But it's not going to do it in a straight line, as you know. And the important point Now, for the short to medium term, is that this medium term upward trend in the precious metal sector is maturing. But it's the last bit of that move that's usually the best. So we may well see some of these other commodities, such as gold and silver, accelerating the way platinum has been accelerating recently. In the industrial metals, I said the people had written the obituaries for copper. Well, the chart's worth another look here. And copper stocks are falling now. That's when stockpiles are falling. I didn't mean the shares. So copper stockpiles are falling in the LME warehouse. That's certainly a good reason for some of this strengthening demand that we're actually seeing. There's some pretty bearish forecasts out, not surprisingly. One on zinc that Owen posted today and disagreed with in a disciplined fashion, citing what would have to happen for the analysts to be correct on this. But when you get something like zinc that's down over 50% at a time when all this global infrastructure development is continuing, because it's based on their expectation for a big supply increase. But I think that the time to expect these metals to run into trouble is when they're accelerating on the upside, because that's unsustainable. But I think the industrial metals, and for the most part, are cheap and being they're increasing. There's increasing technical evidence that demand is coming in to support these metals, and I wouldn't be surprised to see a good move on the upside. Then the miners. You know how much I like those key big miners, and sure, they'll get 40 some 30, 40, sometimes even 50% swings, but all within these long-term upward trends. And when they plunge, that's the time to buy a little bit more. And if they accelerate upwards, and you decide to take a few profits, well, that would be only prudent. My own stance so far has been to hold these for the long term and worry about trading other things, ditto India and some of my other core investment positions. But there is a case to be made. So again, it's buy low, sell high. If something's doing unbelievably well, it's probably time to think about lightening it up or having a mental stop and saying that you'll come out if it starts to lose momentum, and then increase the position when it's fallen back a long way. This is common sense investment. But the point I was going to make about those miners is that, as the negotiations are taking place with the Chinese regarding iron ore and what's going to be the price for the next 12 months for iron ore. And the Chinese say that they don't want the price to go up more than 30%. And the mining companies are thinking something more along the lines of 60%. Well, it's probably going to be resolved somewhere in between. But let's say it's at 40%, and that would be a conservative figure. I suspect it'll be higher, but let's say it's 40%. How many industries are going to be able to increase their prices by 40% this year? I mean, it's just an astonishingly powerful bullish story overall. And then people say, well, yes, but their costs are going up as well, aren't they? Yes, of course they are. Costs are going up for most businesses. But what will be the impact of those rising costs? Well, it'll mean that these companies won't always be going hell for leather to increase supply. They'll be fairly conservative. Yes, they will want to increase supplies, but they will want to keep costs under control, and that will moderate the supply increases. That's been the case all along, and I think will remain so. And demand, provided we don't get a global recession, and I certainly don't think we're going to get a global recession, demand for these metals is also rising. And of course, it's not just from China, although China has been the biggest buyer. It's all over the world, literally. Okay, crude oil, same story. It's in a corrective phase here right now, but very much a secular bull market overall. What about the foods? This is getting overheated. I pointed that out previously with soybeans, for instance, also with wheat. But what happened? They went into fairly tight consolidations. In other words, they didn't give up much in the way of gains, and are starting to push upwards once again. Now, my hunch is that this is a rapidly maturing cycle where these foods are just absolutely running riot, and there are very big long positions in there, not least among the hedge funds, and this is getting fairly dangerous here overall. I wouldn't be at all surprised, and was actually told today by someone who knows far more about this sector than I, that he expects the exchanges to put 100% cash deposit requirements on some of these food contracts, such as wheat and soybeans. Now, that would obviously shake a lot of speculators out of the market. And so there will be efforts to prevent this sort of gathering pace of speculation that's taking place in the food markets. There are enough fundamental factors to drive these prices higher, as you know, with the low stockpiles generally and the rapidly increasing demand overall. But I think anybody who's playing those markets at this stage ought to be pretty careful overall. One that I have been buying in here today is lumber, obviously not a food, unless you're a weevil, and but it is an agricultural commodity. The whole commodity sector has been very interesting and a magnet for speculators, and there isn't much that hasn't moved. Well, lumber is one of the ones that hasn't moved, that U.S. contract. People say, oh, well, doesn't that reflect the housing slump overall? Well, sure, that's in the price, but lumber is a global market, and I wouldn't be at all surprised to see some of that big speculative money swing lumber's way. Okay, I've gone on long enough here, so apologies if I've gone on far too far or far too long for you. And I will just say, have an absolutely splendid weekend, which is exactly what I intend to do. All the very best to all of you.